You're listening to FYI Politics with Brett Johnson, joined also by Eric Nelson. Anything new with you today in there? Any exciting news in the world of Eric Nelson?
Not that I can think of. I've been considering going to Michigan this weekend.
Oh, what's in Michigan?
Knock on doors for Bernie Sanders.
That is a great idea, because if you want Bernie Sanders to win the nomination, looking at the math, he needs to pick up 57% of the remaining vote in all of the remaining states, which is difficult, but not impossible. That's at least the way I would look at it. Yeah. 57% is certainly an uphill battle, but it's nothing ridiculous like trying to get 70 or 80%. It's a little bit similar to his numbers he actually had back in 2016, where I think similar to this point in time, he also needed right around like 55 or 60% of the remaining votes. So, yeah, if you are a Bernie Sanders supporter, you got to go out there and start knocking on those doors, just like Eric is saying in there, because time is a-wasting, and it certainly is still possible for him to get that, but you're going to have to put in a lot and a lot of work, and hopefully you can knock on a lot of communities that he struggled in. I know, obviously, he didn't do very well among the black community, so I just don't know what his plan was heading into 2020, because he knew that was an issue heading into this election cycle, where after he struggled so much with black voters back in 2016. I just kind of sit here and wonder why he wasn't opening up offices in some of these areas of the southern United States, especially in places like Alabama and Mississippi, where you have communities that are majority black populations. I think he should have been opening field offices down there, having organizers.
Yeah,
you're pretty involved with the campaign. What do you think?
I know that he had some of that. I think that he was kind of assuming that no matter what he did, Joe Biden would take those states pretty handily. And he hasn't been doing, you know, that poorly in amongst all black community. It's primarily like the southern black areas and the older black people.
Yeah, and
but the young people just haven't come out to vote.
Right, so. And that nuance is important to point out, because he did do fairly well among black voters in California, at least, but it's been mainly in the South where he struggled, and that even still goes to his strategy, too, where even if you have no chance of winning, let's say, Alabama or Mississippi or South Carolina or pick your favorite southern state, if he could at least get 30% or even 35% of the vote in those states, those delegates still count towards your overall number. The Democrats do their delegate math much different than the Republicans, where on the GOP side, they primarily determine their delegate count in each state on a winner-takes-all basis, where Democrats do it proportionately. And where Sanders has really gotten hurt is the fact that, yeah, he got blown out in the South, but then you even look like states like California, or even I was reading about how Colorado, how even though he won that state by a pretty wide margin, because you had like three other candidates that picked up at least 15% of the vote, it's going to significantly hurt his delegate haul. So
I will say that one thing, I believe he's viable in every state he's competed in so far. And I mean, there's first couple early states, was Joe Biden even viable? I think he got below 10% in New Hampshire.
Iowa for sure, and New Hampshire. Yeah. New Hampshire, I think he might have, I'm trying to think. Yeah, he might not have been viable in either of those states now that I think about it. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, those are two really small states.
I know, they're small states.
Yeah, yeah. They do create momentum heading forward. But, yeah, Biden at least somewhat, I think, played the strategy a little bit better beyond South Carolina and into Super Tuesday. So, I mean, it's certainly a mixed bag. I mean, it certainly didn't help when you had just about every candidate going on the Biden bandwagon.
Simultaneously.
Yeah, simultaneously, which
yeah.
I saw this pointed out, too. What was Beto O'Rourke doing getting on the Joe Biden bandwagon? Because if I remember right.
At that moment, you mean? Well, I have a theory.
Wasn't it pretty much the Bernie Sanders kind of revolution of 2016 that made Beto O'Rourke a prominent name?
Yeah, I think everyone is trying to ride Biden's coattails because they know he might not last that full 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Are you in the camp that you think he might only serve one term?
I'm in the camp that I don't think he'll serve one term or the full term.
Wow, okay.
I mean, this is a controversial opinion, but I don't think his mind is all there.
And I want to get to that. Well, actually, let's go to it right now. Yeah, he is going to be 78 years old by the time he would be potentially inaugurated. And guess who's going after that competency issue with Joe Biden? None other than his potential general election opponent, Donald Trump. And what I'm afraid, this is what you should be doing, I think, if you're the Biden campaign. You got to take a page out of that Karl Rove playbook where you take your opponent's biggest strength and turn it into their weakness, or you take your biggest weakness and turn it into a strength. The Bush campaign, despite the fact how crappy Bush is, was brilliant at doing this in 2014 against John Kerry. There's even some parallels you can draw between 2004 and 2020, where John Kerry was supposed to be the safe, competent choice for Democrats back in 2004, and Republicans and the Bush campaign used that against him by saying, oh, well, they swift-voted him. They said he flip-flopped on all sorts of issues. They made him come off as looking very incompetent, despite the fact that that was John Kerry's biggest selling point back in that 2004 election. So many people said, and this was, by the way, the first election I could vote in. I even remember caucusing for John Kerry thinking, well, this is the guy who's going to knock off Bush. And I think on the John Kerry campaign strategy, they got caught a little flat-footed by the fact that it was the Rove strategy of turning his strengths into weaknesses and turning some of Bush's weaknesses into strengths. And I hope the Biden campaign takes note of this because
I just don't know how you would turn like having Alzheimer's into being a strength.
Not necessarily a strength, but why are you not, if you're the Biden campaign, pointing out all the weird stuff Trump has done over the past few months and years in terms of his
mental? Have they not been? It seems like, you know, they're constantly going after him. Like, look at this weird guy. He's doing this weird stuff. He's acting strange. But I think Trump can play it off because he's always just trying to show off how great he is. He can't really get lost in conversation because it just goes back to, and I'm the best, and people are telling me I'm the best.
I would go a little bit deeper, though, and, like, point how often he sometimes slurs when he's making speeches.
That is
true. Point to those types of issues. Yeah, not like the goofy things he says, because, like it or not, that's just Trump being Trump. I think you need to go to that competency issue of talking about how maybe he is suffering from some sort of mental illness or maybe early stages of dementia. I'm totally convinced that that's occurring with Donald Trump right now.
Yeah.
He's clearly on some sort of medication when he often does slur his speech or he starts talking and not really making any sense. So I think that's something I would be highlighting if I'm the Biden campaign, where, yeah, maybe you're not turning in that weakness you might have if you're Joe Biden talking about how, oh, I'm going to win on Super Thursday, or I'm a candidate for the U.S. Senate. Certainly you can't turn that into a strength, but you could at least point out that, well, the other guy is even more incompetent, or coming off as more incompetent than even I sometimes do. Obviously,
this is
you're going to phrase that a lot better than I just did, but
this is going to be an incredible debate season, just two men with their brains turning to soup, like saying they're going to fight each other.
Who was it, Hunter, back when we were watching one of our debate parties? I think Hunter even made the comment saying, like, are these two guys going to get in a fist fight if they have a general election debate or when they have a general election?
Yeah, Biden always claims he's going to fight Trump, so we get an old man fight.
Yeah. Wow, it is going to be interesting to see what happens when you do end up getting those two guys debating against each other because you just don't know what's going to happen with them, what Biden might end up saying if he could. Biden, I will give him credit. I think he could throw Trump off a little bit because Biden is pretty good at, well, calling out a lot of bull crap that.
Yeah,
Trump
listen to your
say.
Fat.
Yeah. I think Biden could maybe get him a little bit off track, but then again, Biden is also very susceptible himself to getting off track. Either way, that general election debate is most certainly going to probably go off the rails, but Biden does have some strengths I do at least appreciate. I mean, I will fully admit he was not my first choice, but he does have some strengths I can appreciate, and it is the fact that, like I was referring to, I think he would be much better than some of the other Democrats, going back to even Hillary Clinton in 2016, at possibly calling out Donald Trump and kind of getting him off track.
Oh, yeah, that especially, yeah.
Yeah, I do.
But I was thinking about this, and although Hillary Clinton was kind of an unpopular candidate, she did have that base of support that, you know, supported her no matter what, where I don't know if that exists for Biden.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic. I would agree that he doesn't have that quite a type of loyal support that Hillary had, but I think an advantage he might have over her is that his name is not nearly as toxic as the Hillary Clinton name or brand was.
And he's an incredibly likable person.
Yeah, he does come across as very likable. I mean, even if he were just to be sitting here right next to me, I mean, I would probably find him to be a really personable guy that I would enjoy having a conversation with.
One of the flaws that they try to go after him for is just that he's, like, too personable, that he, you know, becomes too familiar with people too quickly and maybe can, like, invade their personal space.
Yeah, it could be. But, again, credit to him.
If that's one of his flaws, then I think that's a good flaw to have.
Yeah, I'm exactly with you. I mean, I've spent part of this week talking a lot about some of the negative aspects of the Biden campaign, but he certainly does have some big assets as well, and I think that is one of them. That is a flaw, that he's too personable. I think that's actually a strength. That's what people are really looking for sometimes in presidential candidates. They don't want people who seem very aloof and distant, and Hillary Clinton sometimes gave off that vibe. Now, of course, I heard once you actually talk with her in a one-on-one situation, she actually does come off as being very personable.
Oh, yeah.
But in, like, those small group settings, she did come off as sort of awkward and manufactured and aloof.
Even older interviews you see with her, she seems much more personable. Mm-hmm. And I think that it was just like a crafted image to some extent later on, whereas I have to be very serious, I have to talk about
it. Yeah, she was certainly focused group to a very large extent during that campaign, and I'm not sure Biden can quite be that focused group as Hillary Clinton.
No, I don't think that he can receive those directions.
No, I don't think he's quite good at receiving directions in that respect, which might be an advantage for him going forward.
Yeah.
Either way, just wrapping up some final thoughts here on the presidential week that we've had. We've mainly been focusing our shows on presidential politics. And by the way, if you want to continue the conversation, we're at 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. No matter what your thoughts are on the Biden versus Bernie debate, please do realize that ultimately what's going to have a much bigger impact on your life in the 2020 elections is going to be what happens in the House elections, and what happens in the Senate elections, and what happens in your state legislative elections, or in your constitutional offices, depending on what state you live in, or what happens in the governor's election, or depending on what city you live in, maybe even your local municipality elections. Those are going to have a much bigger impact on your day-to-day life. And let's start with Congress just talking about that. So let's say you're a Bernie Sanders fan out there, and he somehow does make a comeback and gets the nomination and then ends up winning the general election. Well, if you give Bernie Sanders a Republican-controlled Senate, guess what's going to happen to a lot of his agenda? It's not going to go anywhere. Now, conversely, you had something to say about that there, Eric?
Well, I'd say that he has, like, contingency plans for a lot of that I've read. Like, the jobs program is apparently an executive controlled position still for the New Deal.
But I always have concerns about doing that from executive action, is that all it takes is the next president to overturn what you did. That's essentially what happened to Obama during his second term. So much of what he did during his second term just got overturned by Trump because it was done by executive action.
Mm-hmm.
It's much harder to undo what happens through legislative action, hence why Obamacare never ended up getting repealed. It's very difficult to get something changed legislatively as opposed through executive action. So, yeah, I would say even if you like a Bernie Sanders and he somehow ends up coming back and winning, you give him a Republican Senate, guess what? He's pretty much going nowhere with any of his policies. Now, conversely, let's say Joe Biden wins, and let's say you're in the camp where you're maybe not thrilled with Joe Biden being the Democratic nominee, but you vote for him anyways. If you give Joe Biden a Democratic Senate and also a hefty majority in the House of Representatives, guess what? You might be able to actually move Joe Biden in a more progressive direction. It comes down to how your Congress is structured in terms of how your president will end up governing. That's why even if you look at the Trump administration, his legislative accomplishments are very much lacking. So much of what he's done can simply be overturned by another Democratic president, since, similar to Obama during his second term, a lot of what Trump has been doing has gone through executive action, not through legislative action. So I would say, no matter your thoughts on Bernie or Biden, keep in mind it's going to be those congressional elections that have a much bigger impact on how the eventual president will end up governing. By the way, same if you're a Republican listening out there and you're a Donald Trump fan. If you're a Republican and you still have a Democratic House, guess what? Trump's agenda largely is still going to be stalled, just like it has been for the past 2 years. Let's continue with the phone calls. We got Gene in Forest Lake. Hey there, Gene. What's on your mind today?
Yes. I heard what you said about Joe Biden, about his qualifications.
Mm-hmm.
One of the concerns I have, though, is about his cognition. He does appear to have confusion at times. That's a bit concerning. There was a letter to the editor in the St. Paul paper this week, and the reader said that he alluded to the fact that he was running for senator rather than president, mm-hmm. and he called it Super Thursday instead of Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, when I went online, I saw that he's made a lot of statements that could allude to some confusion on his part.
In his defense, though, he has done that for years and even decades. He's even made those types of gaffes going back to the 1990s. So
I don't remember him ever, like, forgetting large parts of the Declaration of Independence he's quoting, though.
Yeah, I guess that's
one, too. Or confusing his sister with his wife.
Well, even if you watch that video, I'll play devil's advocate for you here. He really wasn't looking to see who was on what side. He might have just literally assumed that his wife was still on his left side and his sister was still on his right side. That's at least me trying to play a little defense there for Joe Biden. But even if you look at his past history, he's made gaffes like that going back to the 90s and 2000s. But maybe to some extent, like you're referring to there, Eric, they weren't quite too, yeah. Some
they
of
were
the
more
major-
like mix up of words rather than like confusion or mistakes, I feel.
So, yeah, part of it probably is associated with the type of personality he has where he sometimes talks before he actually thinks.
Yeah, I believe
which
that.
Which is certainly part of his personality. But I would just continue to harp on this if I'm someone that's strategizing for the Biden campaign. Anytime you get called out by that by the Trump campaign, you're tenfold attacking Trump for having those same sorts of issues. I'm really afraid that this could end up being the Swift boat type issue for Joe Biden that Republicans did to John Kerry back in 2004. So I would be hammering Trump 10 times as hard every time he goes after Biden for those competency type issues. We have Patricia in Shorewood who wants to chime in on Joe Biden. Hi there, Patricia. What are you thinking today?
Hi there. Actually, I want to chime in on Bernie. And couple of questions. One is, why are you – this is supposed to be a progressive radio station, I thought, and it sounds like you've already crowned Joe Biden as the next nominee.
Well, I'm looking at the overall odds of the situation. As I referred to in the beginning of the show, Bernie still does have a path going forward. It's very much an uphill climb.
Yes,
he needs 57% of the remaining vote, which is similar to what he needed back in 2016 at this point. So I'm certainly playing the odds. While Bernie's not out of it, I would say...
I didn't hear it.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about at the beginning of the show. So I'm primarily going with how the odds look going forward.
Sir, I'm in a car, and I just pulled over because I thought, oh, my God, you're going on and on about Joe Biden doing this, Joe Biden doing that. And, I mean, Trump's going to get him on just his record. I mean, privatization of prisons, the Iraq War, Anita Hill. I mean, the list goes on and on. He's got a horrible record. And when people find that out, you won't even have to go with the gaffes, which we do make wonder if he's still all there. And with Bernie, you know, he's the only candidate out there who's really looking at the earth changes and saying, hey, we have a problem, and he's got a solid plan for going forward. He's working with young people who are excited to move forward and go with that. I mean, I'm a senior. I'm in my 70s. Good grief. But he is, like, the most stellar candidate. I mean, at another time, anybody who would have won the first three states that he won, they would have been flipping and saying, this is our candidate. The mainstream media, and you sound mainstream, have been just all about anybody else, anybody but Bernie, and coming on and saying things like, oh, if he gets it, I think I'll have to vote for Trump. I mean, key people, and then the whole DNC ganging up again. What a fool. I mean, we're looking at climate change. He has a solid plan. Medicare for all. More than 75% of the people
okay,
want
Patricia,
that.
I get where you're coming from right here, but okay, you got to go to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show. You got to be prepared to work extremely hard to get him the nomination. He has an uphill climb. It's still very possible for him to get that, but you got to be willing to put the work in right there. You can't just wax poetic about how, oh, Bernie's getting messed up out of the nomination, which, by the way, he largely is. Yeah, of course, all of the moderate candidates are coalescing.
You want to come to Michigan with me, Patricia?
Pardon me?
You want to come knock on doors
Eric's
with me
going
in
to Michigan?
Michigan?
To knock on doors, yep.
I wish I could. I can't right
me too.
Now.
Because that's exactly what you need to do. Exactly what Eric is saying.
But
in
I
there
can
if
make
you
phone
want
calls, and I will be
that's
doing
great.
That.
No, and that's exactly what you need to do, and I certainly
talking to people there.
Yeah, and I certainly commend you for doing that, Patricia. That's the exact type of work you need to do to actually get him back on track for the nomination. It's not just going to be enough to post social media memes and so on and so on. Obviously,
absolutely
not saying
not.
That you're doing that.
Saying,
yeah. But
and I'm not.
Yeah,
but
and I
also want to say, you know, take a look at a serious look at Biden and who he is and what he's done in his past. Take a look at Bernie and who would be the better one. I'm so sick of that horrible lie. You have to vote for the lesser of two evils and all that kind of thing. Vote for the one that you really believe is going to make a change that we need in this country. That's what I'm saying.
All right, Patricia.
And I am working for him, and I am working with Downhouses. I want our representative back in there.
All right, sounds good. Patricia, encourage you to also go back and listen to prior shows. I even brought up how generally when you have the lesser of two evil candidates, the lesser of two evil strategy almost never works, and that's true for both Republicans and Democrats. But do appreciate the phone call there. Yeah, I get the frustration there if you're a Bernie Sanders supporter. It's a frustrating time when it feels like you are getting the DNC ganging up on your candidate.
Especially when it felt like we had so much inertia,
mm-hmm.
and then it all just, like, everything happened simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I certainly get where you're coming from, and I definitely get the frustration. All right, we're running late, so let's go ahead and take a break. We'll continue with your phone calls, and then also want to get to some news with the state legislature, because I want to talk about three bills that are working their way through, including maybe an insulin compromise, some help with real ID, and what happens if you're a police informant? They're trying to put in some new protections for them. We'll talk about that coming up next here on the show.
You know how it is with vacuum cleaners. You buy them, you break them, then you throw them away, right? Well, not necessarily. Often, fixing your vacuum can be cheaper than replacing it. Ever heard of A1 Vacuum in Roseville? They offer free estimates. So if you wish your vacuum worked like new again, drop by. A1 Vacuum is ready to help clean up your vacuum cleaner act. Find us at a-1vacuum.com or call 651-222-6316.
Hey, Twin Cities, are you trying to move your side hustle to your main hustle? Having trouble leveling up your back office? Getting stuck on how to find investors so you can secure that bag? Then you need to come to Connect Up Summit Friday, March 13th and Saturday, March 14th at Metro State in St. Paul. Connect Up is a two-day summit offering hands-on workshops and connects small businesses with each other, local investors, as well as other local and national resources in the Minnesota entrepreneur ecosystem. Connect Up sells out every year, so get your ticket today. Go to www.connectupmn.com.
Hi, I'm Peter Solak.
And I'm Adam Ostrowski.
We are here at Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces to talk about outdoor fires. Sitting around a fire is the oldest, most basic form of human activity.
What's new is in the way fire is burned. We can show you how to burn cleaner with a lot less smoke.
The radiant heat and light from an open fire is unmatched. It kindles our spirits and connects us to the outdoors. And now it's easier to experience and enjoy.
Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces sells and installs wood and gas burning fire pits and fireplaces. Let us help you experience an outdoor fire without all the smoke.
Come see the many ways you can enjoy a fire outdoors.
Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces has over 35 working wood and gas units on display at the corner of East Franklin and Riverside Avenue in Minneapolis. More information at woodlandstoves.com. Find the fire that works for you. Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces, out of the ordinary products and services since 1977.
Tom Hartman here, letting you know how you can save money with All Energy Solar. One of the myths about solar is that it's too expensive and you need lots of money down. The truth? Solar is available for little or no money down. And if you have a great site for solar, you might even save money right away on a monthly basis. So don't wait to switch. You'll see your investment pay off the sooner you switch to All Energy Solar. So start saving today and visit allenergysolar.com.
Anytime is the right time to update your music collection, so stop in at the Electric Fetus and browse their massive selection. You'll find everything from rock and pop to international and roots, and so much more, on CD and vinyl. Not only is Electric Fetus the best stop for music, but they also carry a wide and unique range of gifts. Bath products, clothing, books, stationery, candles, incense, you name it. That's the Electric Fetus at 2000 4th Avenue South in Minneapolis and online at efetus.com.
Back on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson, finishing up some thoughts about the presidential primary we had this past week. And as you heard me talking through that Biden strategy, the reason why I'm bringing that up is that, yeah, if that's who you're going to go with as the nominee, you better be prepared to counter a lot of these attacks you're going to get from the Trump campaign. So that's one of the reasons why I'm talking about that, simply because he is a pretty overwhelming favorite to get the nomination. But as I mentioned a few times back during that last segment, it's still not an impossible path for Sanders to perhaps knock off Joe Biden, especially when you consider the fact that there's, at least in terms of presidential campaigns, there's no one better than Joe Biden at snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. He's had this happen to him in prior presidential campaigns going back to the 80s and then even into the 2000s. Let's talk to Maggie in Minneapolis before we got to head into our next break. Hey there, Maggie, what's on your mind today?
Hi, how's it going?
All right, here.
I've never called into the radio before.
Well, glad to have you have your first call with us here.
Thank you. I wanted to talk about this rhetoric of young voters not showing up, because as we all know, there is this campaign against Bernie, and I think this is the first thing I've heard where it's really sticking on both sides, and it's getting everyone down. So what's being reported is that 13% of young voters, right, 18 to 29 years old.
Mm-hmm.
That is the percentage of voters that came out. 13% of all voters that came out were in that age group. But that age group, it represents, I mapped it out earlier, I looked at a 2020 Pew research of the electorate, and that age group represents 19% of the total electorate. So if my math is right, 13% of 19% is about 68%.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's definitely being played as only 13% of young people came out. But in reality, the amount that young people represented was much higher than, average states come out like 50-some percent. Minnesota's a lot higher, but...
So Maggie, let's back up. Let me make sure I have your numbers correctly that you're talking about right here. So you're saying 13% of the people that participated in Super Tuesday's Democratic primary were between the ages of 18 and 29, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but the overall electorate is 19% of the people are between the ages of 18 and 29. Is that what you're saying as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and that's not registered voters. That's all eligible voters.
That's all eligible voters. I got you. Okay. So you're saying that the youth turnout was actually a little bit better than what's being reported by a lot of other media outlets, correct?
If my math is right, and I'm pretty sure it's close, but it's definitely much, much better than what's being reported as young people aren't coming out. That's just not the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly depends. Yeah, go ahead, Maggie.
Everyone, this rattled everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And the polls now saying Biden's favored to win. Most of those polls go off of momentum. And
mm-hmm.
after Super Tuesday and what happened the days before, it caused panic in a lot of, we saw it in Minnesota. I think
mm-hmm.
Massachusetts saw that too, where, people no longer were going off of, oh, well, I could kind of go with anyone, but I want this person, so I'm going to vote for this person. It went to, all right, I'm hearing Biden is the one I have to go with.
Mm-hmm. Tell you what, Maggie, I'm going to take a break here on the show, but I'm going to go back and run through some of those numbers you gave me. I just want to make sure those percentages work out. It is sometimes tough to do math when you're talking about percentages from within percentages. That even got a little grimace from Eric in there, who I know you do some work with math tutoring, so maybe you can...
Well, I was trying to follow it. So
yeah. Yeah, we'll work on that during the break.
He's doing a thinking face.
It has the 2020 electorate by generation, and mm-hmm. you have to split it out a little bit because 18, Gen Z is 10%,
mm-hmm.
so that's 18 to 23-year-olds, and then that leaves 5% of Gen X falls into that, I believe.
Mm-hmm. I've always been
lost.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've always been lost on the definition of a Gen Z versus a Gen X versus a millennial.
Gen Z. Sorry, millennials.
Yeah. Oh, I get what you're saying.
Millennials and the Zoomers.
Yeah, no, I totally get what you're saying. I was just thinking, yeah, I've always heard different definitions on what those all mean. Well, thanks for the call there, Maggie. First ever call to a talk radio station, and do appreciate that, and hopefully we can chat with you another time.
I appreciate you running those numbers.
All right, thanks. We'll take a look at those. Brett and Eric here on FYI Politics are going to play a little math corner here during our commercial break and see if we can splice out what you're talking there, Maggie. We're also at 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Still do want to touch on those bills that are working their way through the state legislature in just a few minutes. But first, let's get to Art Beat for the Week.
Beat for the Week. I'm Elizabeth Horob, co-host of Connections Radio Show, and today I'll be letting you in on a couple of great arts events you're going to want to attend in the Twin Cities area this weekend. Starting this weekend and running through next, catch Face-to-Face Hmong Women's Experiences playing at Park Square Theater in St. Paul. Face-to-Face Hmong Women's Experiences is an interview-based theater production featuring five local Hmong community members sharing their true stories on stage. Told with heart, humor, and courage, it addresses complex issues such as history and arrival of the Hmong community in St. Paul, coming of age as the first-generation Hmong Americans, and finding your own voice and identity while balancing cultural and family expectations. Through their stories, the cast addresses topics including mental health and depression, bullying, domestic and sexual violence, gender identity, beauty standards, and more. Face to Face is a partnership with the internationally renowned Ping Chong & Company, a New York leader in community-specific interview-based theater events. Go to www.parksquaretheater.org for more information on Face-to-Face Hmong Women's Experiences and to reserve your tickets today. This Sunday at 1 p.m. is the Cat Video Fest 2020 at St. Anthony Main Theater in Minneapolis. Cat Video Fest is a compilation reel of the latest and best cat videos culled from countless hours of unique submissions and sourced animations, music videos, and, of course, classic internet powerhouses. Cat Video Fest is a joyous communal experience only available in theaters and raises money for cats in need through partnerships with local cat charities, animal welfare organizations, and shelters to best serve cats in the area. Feline Rescue Inc. will receive 10% of all ticket proceeds. Cat Video Fest will be this Sunday at 1 p.m. and again on Wednesday, March 11th. Go to Facebook and look up Cat Video Fest to learn more details. That's Art Beat for the Week. I'm Elizabeth Horob, co-host of Connections Radio Show, airing live Saturday mornings at 9 a.m. on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota.
Hey, it's Brett from FYI Politics. Believe it or not, it's time for spring cleaning. You're not the only one who's tired of winter this year. Your carpets are too. Think about the dust, dander, and bacteria living in your carpet with nowhere to go. There's only one real way to get all that gunk out of your home, and that's by calling Zurez. This month, get 3 rooms of carpet Zurezified starting at only $129 plus a free hallway. That's a savings of $55. But you have to mention AM 950 when you call. That's 952-ZUREZ or ZUREZMinnesota.com.
Stop in at Next Chapter Booksellers to find the perfect book for you or the book lover in your life. They also have lots of opportunities to meet authors like Peter Heller on Monday, March 9th at 7 p.m. Heller's new outdoors thriller, The River, tells the story of best friends Jack and Wynn, who set out on their dream canoe trip in Northwest Canada and stumble into situations that will change them forever. That's Next Chapter Booksellers, located south of 94, across from McAllister, and at nextchapterbooksellers.com.
With your AM 950 weather, this is Eric Nelson. Today will be sunny with a high of 41. Tonight, clear skies with a low around 28. Saturday, sunny with a high of 53 and a low around 43. With sunny skies all day and a high of 63. EatLocalMinnesota.com's restaurant of the week is Hazel's Northeast, offering classically inspired, creatively prepared comfort food. This restaurant has scratch dishes rooted in over 50 years of family tradition. Check them out at the corner of 29th and Johnson in Northeast Minneapolis, or see the full menu at EatLocalMinnesota.com.
Back on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Yeah, going back to that last caller, running through some of those numbers, we'll continue working on that because I think there might be some assumptions right there in terms of voter turnout and other percentages that we'll have to work through. And as we were kind of looking at during the break there, Eric, yeah, it's tough to get some of that information 100% accurate, by the way, to throw another percentage number out there. So, yeah, we'll keep working on that, but certainly an interesting statistic that Maggie threw out there during that last segment. Let's switch gears now and talk about Minnesota politics, because for the past year, we've obviously been hearing about how we don't have any emergency insulin funding. Well, today, we might finally have a breakthrough in that regard, as there is a new bill that's being proposed in the Republican-controlled Senate. Now, a few months ago, we had another Republican-controlled Senate bill that tried making its way through, which didn't really get a lot of support from DFLers. But this new bill seems to be on the surface a little bit better than the last bill Republicans tried. And I'm already a little optimistic, being that it's proposed by Senator Scott Jensen, who is, by the way, one of the most reasonable Republicans you'll find in a state legislature. Probably a reason why he's also not running for re-election, being that he's in that camp. But this new bill he's put through is Senate File 3019. Now, I want to read through some of the details on this because I still do have some questions on mostly where the funding for this emergency insulin would come from. So Senate File 3019 relies on insulin manufacturers to supply the hormone for diabetics who cannot afford it using existing patient assistance programs to resupply pharmacies who provide both emergency and long-term supplies for patients deemed financially eligible. The bill was approved on a voice vote in the Senate Health and Human Services Committee yesterday. So basically, under the bill, someone with a valid prescription for insulin but who needs emergency insulin can go to a pharmacist and receive a 30-day supply at no charge. Now, of course, the problem is who ends up paying for that, because someone has to get paid, and if the pharmacy is giving that away for free, well, then the pharmacy has to get reimbursed and so on and so on. So the big question is, where does that money come from? So continuing, the maker of that insulin would reimburse and resupply the pharmacy, and the companies would have to provide the insulin to patients who meet financial eligibility rules via their patient assistance programs. Eligible patients would include those with no insurance or high deductible insurance, and those not eligible for other subsidized programs like medical assistance or MinnesotaCare, who have income less than 400% of the federal poverty level. So still, as I'm reading through this, I'm a little fuzzy on where the funding is going to come from. It looks like it would come from existing patient assistance programs that they would use to resupply pharmacies. But then my question would be, well, aren't we in essence taking that money from potentially another program? But still, this does look like it's on the right track. So compared to another bill addressing the issue, which is the House version, which is HF 3100, which passed the House a couple of weeks ago, the Scott Jensen Republican bill has no large fees on insulin makers for the emergency supplies, and it does not use MnSure to administer the program or determine eligibility. Instead, it imposes fines on manufacturers who do not cooperate with the program and creates a board to review complaints from patients who think they were improperly denied help through the patient assistance program. Jensen was quoted as saying, "Every unit of insulin under this program will be provided by the manufacturers. No patient will fall through the cracks, and there will be audits and accountability in place to assure that." The size of the fines have not yet been set, but Senator Jensen said that they need to set up something to make sure insulin makers would actually take part in the program. He's laid out, at least for now, a base of a $100,000 fine in the new bill, at least as a placeholder. So there's still some questions about how you get some funding for this. I'm still concerned that they're going to be using this from existing patient assistance programs, because I'm afraid, well, are you taking away funding from other programs and other people who need emergency medical assistance? But then the other thing I have a little bit of a question about is this idea that you're going to find manufacturers who don't cooperate with this program, and you need to make sure that this fine you potentially put on insulin manufacturers is large enough so they do comply. Because, like any business, they're going to run a cost-benefit analysis. If the fine costs them less than actually supplying the free insulin to patients who need it in emergencies, well, guess what? Those companies are going to eat the fines every single time. So that's one aspect I'm concerned about. The other one would be this. So let's say part of this program is going to be funded from fines that would potentially be placed on insulin manufacturers who don't agree to participate. Well, let's say they all do agree to participate. Well, then you might have a little bit of a shortfall in this program since you're no longer collecting fines. Either way, though, this is an improvement on the previous Republican bill, which in essence made you plan on having an emergency, which those are kind of an oxymoron, planning for an emergency. That's not something you can really do. But it's a bill that I think is a step in the right direction, but I still would like to see this fine probably a little bit bigger than $100,000 because I'm still afraid that companies are going to say, all right, we'll pay that fine because it's going to be less than actually providing that free insulin to patients. It's still that basic cost-benefit analysis, and if companies find the fine is going to be cheaper than actually manufacturing and providing free insulin, well, yeah, like I said, they're just going to take that fine every day of the week. So that's one bill working its way at least through the state Senate. Like I said, a step in the right direction. We'll see if there's some improvements that can be made, especially if they have to go to a conference committee with the House. But at least it looks like the state Republican-controlled Senate is getting a little bit more serious on providing emergency insulin bills. One of the other bills I want to talk about has to do with Real ID. I recently got my Real ID last year. Thankfully, I have that, so when I need to fly later this year and into next year, I'll be able to fly. I don't know about you, Eric. Do you have your Real ID yet, or you still have that old-style version of identification?
Well, I just recently got a new ID, so I probably have the Real ID.
So you have the real one? That's actually the same boat I fell into. I assume I have the Real ID because I got it. What was it? I think a little less than a year ago, so I'm assuming I have the correct one. I can't imagine they would be.
It took like 7 months to get it, so they must have been transitioning.
That's what I'm hoping. I still want to look mine up more because apparently to get this new Real ID, you need all sorts of different requirements, and some people have been denied Real ID or Real ID due to some real technical issues that the legislature is trying to fix. It's under Senate File 3901, not 3901. That's 3901. So apparently, as I was reading up on this, the bill comes in response to a request by the Driver and Vehicle Services Division that the job of processing Real ID applications would be made somewhat easier if the staff didn't have to reject documents for really kind of dumb technical reasons. One example would be this. A utility bill is currently invalid to prove residency if the addresses have different last names, which effectively means if you have a married couple with different names or if you have a roommate and you share your utility bill, you might be out of luck in that regard. Another current requirement is that a pay stub from an employer has to have the employer's phone number on that pay stub. And apparently, I don't know if you look at pay stubs from past jobs, a lot of times you don't have the employer phone number on that pay stub.
I've never looked. So
I never have either.
It doesn't seem like something that would be on it, but I don't know.
Yeah, apparently that's a requirement, though, to get your Real ID. So that's been a reason why people have run into even more problems and delays trying to get their identification, which, by the way, you need by October 1st if you want to jump on an airplane. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to fly. So, yeah, at least this bill that they're trying to get through the legislature is trying to deal with that. But, yeah, I've never actually looked to see if there's a phone number listed on my pay stub. I'll have to go into my office and check that out after the show. And then I didn't even think about that aspect of having a utility bill because, yeah, if you have a roommate and their name is on it, you're pretty much out of luck. Or, like they were referring to in the other example, if you're a married couple and you still use different last names, you also might be out of luck if it's not your last name that's on that utility bill. This all really stems, though, from the fact that we've done just a horrible job planning for this as Minnesotans. And, by the way, that's mostly the fault of certain Minnesota Republicans in the legislature. I mean, we've known about this thing that we've need Real ID for years and years and years. And, unfortunately, the Republican legislatures have kind of dragged their feet on this since some of them have concerns about data privacy issues, even though every other state in the country has already adopted Real ID. So there you go, a couple of bills working their way through the state legislature. Briefly want to touch on one more. This comes out of the Rochester Post Bulletin. And this one I found kind of interesting reading through because it has to do with reforms for people who are police informants, either voluntarily or for folks who are maybe trying to avoid a longer jail or prison sentence. They say, all right, I'll become a police informant and I'll try to get other people locked up.
It's called flipping, and it almost ought to be illegal.
That was Trump over there, huh?
That's one of my favorite Trump quotes.
What, play that one,
no
one more
snitching.
No snitching. Yeah, that was the term I was looking for.
It's called flipping, and it almost ought to be illegal.
And Trump, by the way, not a fan of this bill, probably, as I'll read you through some details on this one. So this all stems from this guy named Matthew Kloss, who was a Minnesotan who died back in 2019 from a drug overdose while he was working as a Rochester police informant. Most, if not all, law enforcement agencies in the state already have policies in place for what you do for policies when you have a police informant. But Matthew's law that they're trying to get through the legislature focuses more on the rights and protections afforded to a confidential informant, especially for one who may struggle with substance use disorders. And that's something you can obviously picture right there. If you're trying to have someone be a snitch, as President Trump would say, and you're trying to have them be a snitch for other drug dealers, well, if that police informant is already addicted to narcotics or other drugs, that's kind of a recipe for disaster. And that's why several other states have already put in these types of provisions to try to protect these informants from being put in a situation where they could relapse and get back to their drug addictions. And there's some other provisions as well that would provide more protections for people who end up in that situation. And as Trump said, snitches. Well, a lot of times you end up being in that situation because, well, you might need to do that to avoid a longer prison sentence or to avoid a jail sentence. So that one's working its way in the legislature. That is House File 3117, and it's proposed by a Republican of all people, Representative Dwayne Quam. He is a Republican from Byron. So some news from the state legislature. We got one more segment left on the show.
And before we go to the break, I did figure out some of these statistics that we're talking about.
Oh, run them by me. All right.
So I couldn't find an overall demographic breakdown for Super Tuesday, but at least in Texas, it came out to about 13% of the votes were between 18 and 34 years old.
Okay, so 13% of all the Democratic voters were between the ages of 18 to 34. That's what you're saying, right?
Yes.
Okay.
But amongst the entire Texas population is 21 million, and they make up something like – where did I wrote it down. It's like 44% of the entire population. So 13% voted, but they make up 44% of the population.
That seems like a really high number. They make 44% of the population in Texas?
Between 18 and 34.
18 and 34.
Old.
I guess that would explain
the
why Texas.
Median age apparently is 34, so that makes sense. About
yeah,
half.
I guess Texas is one of the fastest growing states in the union. So, yeah, maybe that's some evidence that the youth vote was down a little bit in Texas. We'll run through more numbers on that because it is an interesting thing to look through that our caller brought up during the second segment of the show. All right, we're running late. We've got to take a break. We'll come on back, wrap up FYI Politics with Brett Johnson here on a Friday afternoon.
This message is for all of you sitting in the passenger seat. And apologies if it gets a little uncomfortable, but how does it feel to be at the mercy of someone who thinks a random text is more important than your life? Someone who takes their eyes off the road while speeding along in a 3-ton hunk of steel. Freaky, right? Well, why not just ask them to stop? Or better yet, volunteer to text for them. It might be a little awkward, but believe me, you'll live.
Learn more at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
What kind of a jackass would let an animal pick their insurance? Did you really think a lizard could save you money on car insurance? Would you let a duck pick your health policy? Insurance can be a zoo, but this is ridiculous. What you really need is an insurance agent that isn't looking out for the insurance companies. You need Cheryl at Array, an independent agent with 30 years experience looking for the best rate possible. Quit monkeying around and call 763-504-3067. That's 763-504-3067 for Cheryl at Array, representing you, not the insurance companies.
Companies.
And we're back on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Let's get to a few miscellaneous stories before we have to wrap up the show today. So back in the first segment, I was talking about the significance of those congressional races and how oftentimes they're much more important than the presidential race. Well, one race we could get an early look at is the Iowa Senate race. Joni Ernst is running for re-election, and the very highly regarded Des Moines Register is going to be putting out a poll taking a look at her numbers. And I say highly regarded because they've usually had some of the most accurate polls ever done when it comes to the Iowa caucuses, although curiously they did not put out a poll prior to the Iowa caucuses, at least in 2020. But they're going to have some data put out on Joni Ernst, which I find interesting because some other polling data dating back to last year showed that she was dropping a little bit, although the Iowa Democratic Party is not exactly in a strong position, even though Iowa is sort of a purple state. In fact, I would say the Iowa Democratic Party reminds me a lot of the Minnesota Republican Party, where even though both states are very purple, or at least purplish blue or a purplish red, the state parties for both the Minnesota Republicans and the Iowa Democrats have struggled for years and years on a statewide basis. Or statewide basis, not races. We don't want to drop racism into there. Anyways, though, going back to what I'm talking about.
Not the Minnesota Republicans.
Little Freudian slip right there. Unintentional. Or maybe it was intentional. So what I was saying, though, is that so Minnesota Republicans have not won a statewide race since 2006, and Iowa Democrats are in a similar position where they have not won a statewide race since, I think it was like 2008 or 2010, at least when they had Tom Harkin, I think, as their senator. So we'll have to see what happens with Ernst. That is one of the races that will be key in terms of determining who ends up winning the Senate, and they're expected to release some polling results on that in the next week. Also in the news today, Colin Peterson is going to be running for re-election. Well, not officially yet, but just about every media outlet in Washington is reporting that he will announce he is running for re-election today at some point, although he's not been official yet. In that aspect. But I do like one of the quotes he made a couple of weeks ago speaking to AgriPulse, which is an agribusiness magazine in western Minnesota. He said, "I'm not sure if I want to win in 2020. What a great statement. You're not sure if you want to win. Well, either way, I guess he's the Dems' best chance of actually winning in CD7. And final note, just to touch on something I briefly talked about yesterday with the state high school hockey tournament. I'm going to be proven right. Three of the final four teams in the Class AA tournament are private schools, and this is a trend you're going to see continue for, I think, a lot longer, because if you look at the AA tournament in Minnesota and AA hockey overall, there's not many northern teams that play AA hockey anymore, so eventually that tourney is going to be an all-metro affair, and guess what? That's going to hurt attendance, and the Minnesota State High School League is already in a ton of debt, so yeah, you kind of see where that's going. All the time I got for today on FYI Politics, Matt McNeil's up next.